dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go,
you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Nations past and present tend to have official histories and often official historians. Official histories ultimately have the function of legitimizing that country's rulers. These histories are told from the point of view of those who hold power and thus tend to portray their triumphs as the triumphs of the good over evil. Controlling the general understanding of the past is a necessary part of the manipulation of present public opinion. Even the most bare-knuckle dictatorship cannot maintain control of the majority of the population if they are determined to bring it down. So being seen as legitimate is important to all rulers. Present social problems usually have their roots in past events. By manipulating the understanding of the past, it's much easier for the rulers to lie with impunity about the present. For example, someone familiar with the history of the actions of the American Empire toward Haiti, as well as its involvement in bringing about coup d'etat elsewhere, is likely to be quite skeptical of the official story today and seek facts elsewhere. Tonight on the program, a conversation with Dr. Michael Parenti about his studies of the Roman Empire, a look at war resistance within the military during the Vietnam War, how the U.S. is once again controlling elections in El Salvador, and more on resisting indoctrination from disciplined minds.
Stealing and lying and gambling, and I take it my way.
Dr. Michael Parenti has spent the past several decades analyzing the economics and politics of modern empire and its social implications. He's the author of 17 books on politics, economics, and the media. In his latest book, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, which was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize, he turns his attention to a famous empire of the ancient world and brings out the suppressed history behind one of its best-known events. That famous murder on the Ides of March more than 2,000 years ago has come down through history as the act of patriotic senators deposing a tyrant to save the Roman Republic. I spoke with Michael Parenti earlier this month about his book and research that reveals the true story of the assassination, one very different from what most of us are taught, and what the lessons of history can teach us about the present.
I found that the history of the Roman Republic and Empire is as distorted as the history of later empires and the history that we often see written today. It's written by the victors, and historians throughout the ages shared the view of the assassins, namely that they were good Republicans, as you say, and they opposed Caesar because he was usurping power and he was ambitious and he was dictatorial and he was threatening the Republic. The truth is, those Senate oligarchs, those rich, wealthy Senate oligarchs, Brutus, Cassius, and the others who killed Caesar, had nothing against one-man rule if that one man ruled in their interests. And that isn't what Caesar did. He, in fact, was guilty of distributive politics. He met the same fate that about a dozen reformers before him had also met, all of them being people who tried to impose some reforms that benefited the common Roman populace. And that really was their real crime. and all of them, just as with leaders today who try to do something for the people, Aristide, Hugo Chavez, numbers of others, all of them are maligned as power-hungry, usurpers, violating the Constitution and the like. And what they really were doing was land redistribution, luxury taxes on the rich, rent easements, debt cancellation, food rations for the very poor. They were doing things that benefited the poor, and this is what the rich oligarchs could not tolerate. And so they killed Caesar and hundreds of his supporters, just as they killed Tiberius Gracchus, Gaius Gracchus, Flaccus, Drusus, Catiline, Clodius, any number of other reform leaders over that century before Caesar. All of them and their followers, thousands of their followers. And that history is largely just skimmed over. It's rather amazing.
Why do you think that is?
I think the reason that St. Augustine looks at ancient Rome exactly the way Cicero does, and Tillemont in the 17th century, and Gibbon in the 18th century, and Mommsen in the 19th century, and all these historians today all looked at it the same way, is because they all, despite their differences in cultures and epochs, in language and nationality and whatever else, they all shared the same common class ideology. And that was to presume the virtue of the better elements of society and presume the venality of those who tried to do something for the common people.
And the better elements of the society being the people who were wealthy and powerful?
The presumably better elements of the society, the wealthy and the powerful. The corollary of that also is that they also accept the view that has come down through history of the Roman people as just given over to bread and circuses. That phrase of Juvenal's has come down through us through the ages. And the images of people who spend their time on the dole, just getting free handouts and going off to the free entertainment in the arenas. And that's part of the same picture, that these demagogues, these leaders, these reform leaders like Caesar and the others, were pandering to the irresponsible layabouts, the masses, the fickle-minded, empty-headed, emotion-ridden, selfish, destructive masses. That's the image we have of the Roman people, a mob, a rabble. It's the image we have of the people of Paris in the French Revolution, a mob, a rabble that just wanted to sit around and gleefully send these dignified, lovely, handsome noblemen to the guillotine. And that kind of same class bias is operative here. What I did in my book was look at who the Roman people actually were. And they were masons and carpenters and construction workers and dockers and jobbers, teamsters, innkeepers, scribes, teachers, also the coppersmiths, blacksmiths. They were the toiling proletariat of Rome. And what did they do throughout Roman history? They fought and overthrew a monarchy. It took about 200 years of struggle from 730 BC to about 502 BC. And they then instituted a republic and fought to democratize it, to take powers away from the rich Senate oligarchy. They fought for popular assemblies. They fought for and got a secret ballot. They fought for freedom of speech and for the civil liberties of Roman people. They fought to set up a tribunal of tribunes who were elected by the people, who could veto some of the acts of the Senate. They fought for all the other things, land redistribution, rent controls, debt easement, and the like. They fought for whatever were the decent and progressive things in history. And they weren't a mob or a rabble. I mean, the real lynch mob mentality was in the Senate itself. We go out and kill anybody who begins to infringe on our interests. That's the real gangster mob right there, the guys with the daggers, the ones who had death squads. I have a chapter in the book called Demagogues and Death Squads. These Roman oligarchs, these rich senators, had death squads. They didn't call them that, but they pretty well, Appian actually does call them death squads, at least it's translated that way. And they were what Mommsen called the bludgeon boys. They went around and they killed people who tried to struggle for better things.
How much of a republic really was the Roman Republic? In spite of the struggles that you just mentioned, it seemed from reading your book that ultimately the Roman people really didn't prevail in their struggles against the Roman ruling class, and the society just got more and more repressive until it was brought down by an invasion from the outside and an overly extended military empire. What was Roman society like?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I call it a republic for the few, which was a play on one of my books called Democracy for the Few, which is a study of the U.S. government. And the voting in the assembly was heavily skewed to favor the rich oligarchic class. The Senate, which was a total oligarchy, really, made up mostly of rich individuals, many of them conservative. Not all, by the way. There were some senators who did side with Caesar and the like.
How did you get into the Senate?
If you got elected to one of the major magistrates' offices, you became a senator. If you got elected as to consul, which was the highest office, which might take some years, you then became a member of the aristocracy, the nobilitas. But it was mostly the people who were selected to run for election, the people who were selected to run for these offices were usually people from senatorial homes. It also was hereditary. If you had any parentage who had been in the Senate, then you automatically could be in the Senate. It really extended to maybe a couple of hundred families. And that Senate controlled the budget. They controlled the foreign affairs, questions of war and peace, and a lot of other issues. So the Republic was less than ideal. It had many undemocratic features. The magistrates, the courts, the juries that were set up, were all inhabited by the senators. They passed judgment on all these kinds of cases, various kinds of cases. So, but the people, if sufficiently mobilized and really getting their, bringing their votes in from the countryside and everywhere else, and pushing hard enough, they could occasionally pass some decent reforms, which is what happened, which is what made the senators so furious.
This republic for the few, as you talk about, was intimately bound up at the same time with an empire. How did that affect the republic over time? Rome didn't start out as an empire, did it?
Correct. The Republic was also an empire. while there was this Republic at home, any number of senators to gather fame and celebrity and wealth did venture and raise armies and go off and conquer different provinces. War was very functional for the elite class, just as it is today. It allowed them to recruit farmers from the Campania region who served in the infantry. These farmers are away at war for years on end. They can't keep up their farms. The rich aristocrats buy up or take up or steal their farms and turn them into large plantations, which are now run by slave labor rather than by free farm labor. So they do that. Second, they get soldiers to fight in the war. Third, the war gives them plunder and and booty from the provinces, wealth that they can gather and enrich themselves and use to pay off their little private armies to continue their power. So they use their wealth to extend their power. They use their power to extend their wealth. At the same time, the landless farmers now become proletariat in the cities. They crowd into the cities. The Roman proletariat lived in these tenements, 8 and 9 stories high, which had enormous rents. So you had families doubling and tripling up. So that was another function. It created urban markets. It depressed wages in Rome because of the surplus displaced population from the countryside pouring into the city. And so you had the best of all worlds. And it gave you a lot of slave labor. One of the things you got from conquest was slaves, and you bring them back and you work them to death in the mines or on the latifundia, and you continue to enrich yourself. So war was then as now very good for the ruling class. You raid the public treasure, you accumulate resources and wealth from other countries, and you weaken and you demoralize the classes below you.
Well, then as now, did people understand the uses of war, or were they caught up in patriotic fervor?
It's a good question. You know, we don't know that much about what the people were doing or thinking. A lot of ancient history is a sort of a puzzle with most of the pieces missing. Thanks to the Christians, when they came in, they destroyed all the Roman libraries. They destroyed many of the fine Roman histories that had been written. They destroyed all the records. So we don't have anything really much. But from what we can surmise and from what we can gather, the Roman people, the people were at times skeptical of these conquests and these far-off things, critical of the plunder and the bloodletting. At other times they were drawn in by it and, you know, and rah-rah, and they joined the triumphs and share in the glory of that was Rome. So they got taken in by it. Some of them did and some didn't. And it varied from time to time.
And I'm speaking with Dr. Michael Parenti, author of The Assassination of Julius Caesar. You have said on a number of occasions that many of these wars of empire that were fought by Rome were always or often justified in terms of an outside threat, that these lands which were to be conquered were threatening the Roman Republic and the Roman people.
Yes, like any empire, the imperialists portray themselves as virtuous, innocent individuals who are forced to take measures to defend their country. Rome was always being encircled by enemies. Rome was always fighting for a breathing space. Rome was always being assailed by terrorists. Rome was always threatened. Rome had to go out and rescue its allies or help its allies. And if there weren't any allies, allies would be invented. I quote Schumpeter on that. He's rather eloquent, talking about the hypocrisies of empire and the mythology of empire. And what is interesting, the book is written on two levels, the history and then also the way the history has itself been written by the historians. And it's amazing how they buy into this idea of a Roman Empire that was benign and brought stability and brought order, and how the people who were conquered were really grateful to be part of this empire now and felt real good about it. And you hardly hear a word about shattered armies and burned villages and raped women and destroyed crops and herds and plundered treasures and enslaved populations and overtaxed populations and the like. There isn't really that much on the seamy, ugly side of empire.
Well, now that brings me to Cicero, who is one of the most famous historical characters of Rome, that seems to have been the Tom Brokaw or Dan Rather of his day?
Yeah, I don't see him as a Tom Brokaw. I see him more as a Henry Kissinger, you know, serving the ruling elites and becoming, well, he was wealthy from the beginning. He came from a wealthy family, but he had no lineage. He had nobody, no previous member of his family had been in the Senate. So he was a new man and an upstart. And he was actually looked down upon by the aristocratic snobs, including Brutus and Cassius. He often complained about how they treated him so dismissively, even when they were asking him for favors and he was knocking himself out and tripping all over himself to serve them. Cicero is the pet. He's the hero of classicists, Latin teachers, scholars throughout the centuries. 90% of the primary sources we have are Cicero's. We have his writings, his works, all his many public speeches and court cases. And we have a real, what I felt was a real a treasure trove of Cicero, his personal letters. And it's his letters I really went to and read most closely, because in his letters, that's where he's talking off the cuff, and that's where he's talking the truth. And he reveals his crass class interests and talks about how, you know, Caesar is making all these terrible changes, or we're losing our rents in Campania, he's going to try to redistribute the wealth, is terrible, and, you know. And when Caesar was killed, Cicero wrote a letter to Atticus saying, this is terrible, we're keeping all the Caesar is gone, but we're keeping all the reforms, which were the very reasons we hated him. So, I mean, that makes my case. He didn't say, oh, we hated him for his arrogance. We hated him for his power hunger. We hated him because he was a usurper and a dictator. He's dead now, so he can't be all those things anymore. He says, we've still got all the things that made us hate him, which were his reforms. And Cicero was a reactionary, a conservative. He disliked democracy. He liked the Sulla dictatorship that had been in 80 BC. There's a good example. Sulla was a conservative general who beat the reformers, brought an army into Rome, took over the government, murdered, executed 50 senators who were not conservative enough, who were suspected of being sympathetic to the popular cause, murdered about 2,000 equestrians who were of upper-class people who themselves weren't conservative enough, and then killed thousands and thousands of Democrats and ordinary people who had organized. Well, Cicero thinks very highly of Sulla. He said, on the whole, a very good government and very good rule, although sometimes moderation was wanting. I mean, a little slap on the wrist, and that's about it. Now, when Sulla came to power, Julius Caesar was only in his early 20s, 21 or 22, and just married. And Sulla and Caesar came from a reformist family and was very closely linked to very prominent reformers, Marius and Cinna. Marius had died a natural death, and Cinna was murdered by Sulla. Cinna was Caesar's father-in-law. There are too many names in Roman history, somebody once said. But in any case, Sulla offered Caesar to join his inner circle. He said, divorce your wife, Cinna's daughter, and you marry someone I appoint to you. Which, by the way, is very common practice, to seal alliances through marriage, a practice which the European aristocracy used right on into the 19th and 20th centuries, early 20th. And if Caesar had been nothing but an opportunist and a power-hungry usurper, he would have leaped at this opportunity to join Sulla's camp. Instead, he risked everything, lost his patrimony, lost his wife's dowry, lost everything, almost lost his life, and fled rather than serve in Sulla's camp. So that proves that Caesar was not just out for himself. He had some very real political differences with this conservative claque, these optimates, as they would call this aristocracy.
Now, we don't normally think of Rome as being an intensely mercantile society. I think most people have a notion of people in togas and baths and gladiators, and but in your book, everything seemed to turn upon slumlords and their own form of privatization, seizure of public lands by members of the aristocracy, by people right. in the Senate.
Privatizing those lands, right.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about the situation of public accommodation that existed in Rome and the field of struggle over that, over privatizing those resources?
Well, probably the most significant of those resources was the Ager Publicus, it was called, which were the public lands, farmlands in the Campania region around Rome, very fertile lands. And those lands, for a couple of centuries, were farmed by poor small farmers. They were public lands. The farmers paid a modest rent to the Roman public treasury, so Rome got revenue from that land. And the farmers raised food that victualled all of Rome. They sold the food to the citizenry in Rome. So here you had human needs being met, production being performed, markets being satisfied, public treasury raising public income, people doing productive work, making a living, all of this going on, and the very rich weren't making a penny out of it. They weren't getting their little extortionist shakedown, known as profits. So little by little, they took this land away from the small farmers, either with phony deeds or the usual, just the way the U.S. mining interests took land away from farmers in the American West when they discovered coal or silver or gold or whatever on the land. They'd go in, and of course these farmers didn't have any deeds. Their families had been there for generations and all. They'd go in and drive them off. And if the farmer didn't want to sell for the garage sale price, if he didn't want to just leave, then they brought their strong-arm thugs in, which is what the Roman aristocrats did and what the U.S. mining interests did, their gun gangs in, and shot them up and killed them and drove them out and took the land. So by about the 2nd century B.C., the Roman aristocrats had pretty much, early in the 2nd century B.C., the Roman aristocrats had pretty much taken over all this land and turned it into the slave labor latifundia system.
And how long is this before the period of the assassination of Julius Caesar, just to locate this in time a little?
Well, let's say within a couple of generations of this situation, the reformers started their counterattack, and that was with Tiberius Gracchus in 133 BC. And he was assassinated for his efforts. And as I said, there was a whole bunch of other reform leaders assassinated. And Caesar was the last of them. He was murdered on 15 March 44 BC.
Okay, now it seems that although we're dealing with a putative republic there, the real form of government, I get the impression after reading your book, is government by political assassination. Government by political assassination, it seems to me, is not restricted to the ancient world. But we have seen examples of that all over this globe, bringing us to even the situation that's happened in Haiti, where the elected leader was not assassinated but kidnapped. Okay, this is so well documented. Yet for some reason, and I noticed it even today, I was hearing a bit of the testimony of a congressional hearing in which a deputy Secretary of State, Roger Noriega, was being grilled by some members of Congress regarding what had happened in Haiti and what the U.S. role in it was. And the response was, oh, well, there's all these people with their conspiracy theories.
Did Noriega use the term conspiracy theories? Isn't that something?
Yes, conspiracy theories.
Isn't that something? Yeah.
Yes. So of course, the minute one says the word conspiracy theories, then that is like saying that the person speaking lives in a world of fantasy, has no facts, and is possibly insane and maybe a moron.
Right.
And this is used constantly by people on the right and by people on the left to dismiss lines of inquiry. Can you talk about that, please?
Yeah, well, conspiracy is not just a theory. There are conspiracies. It happens to be a concept in law. People go to jail for perpetrating conspiracies. So there are conspiracy is any unlawful act that's perpetrated by two or more people or using illegal means to commit some act.
Of which an assassination would fill the bill, right?
Yeah, and so would an overthrow of a democratically elected government fill the bill. I mean, it's not as if we don't know and have in our public record ample evidence that the U.S. has conspired and overthrown democratically elected governments. It's a matter of public record that the U.S. did this in 1954, 56 in Guatemala. They played an active role in Chile in 1973. They had a disruptive, destabilizing role in Jamaica. They played a role supporting UNITA in Angola and carrying on a civil war. I mean, you can go on. And when that fails, when they can't destabilize the country because the existing reformist government also controls the military and has a lot of support and all that, which is what Aristide was never allowed to do, when they can't do that, then they'll use direct invasion, and they invade the country under some pretense, as they did in Grenada and in Panama and in Yugoslavia and in Iraq, which Iraq is not wasn't a democratic government, and it was a terrible dictatorship. But they always forget to tell you that it was the U.S. who put that dictatorship in the first place. So this use of the term conspiracy, is also used whenever you suggest that the rich and powerful exercise power and use their wealth and power. If you say these things are being done to aid the corporations or this, that, this, oh, what do you have, a conspiracy theory? Or the ruling interests are doing these things to support their own interests. Oh, you have a conspiracy theory. No, they're there. They're there selflessly supporting us. They're there serving us. School teachers can gather and coordinate and seek out what their interests are and try to pursue policies to support themselves. Farmers can do this. You can do it in your normal life. It's understood you might make calculations about what you're going to do, where you're going to live, should you get this job or try that or something else. But the minute you suggest that the Rockefellers, the Morgans, the Mellons, the DuPonts, and the Fortune 500 and these people, the minute you suggest that they consciously pursue their own interests and prevail upon the government the way everybody else tries to, not only prevail upon the government, but get their people into office and taking over the top policy-making positions, the minute you suggest that, you're called, a conspiracy theorist. The presumption is that these people are totally innocent. They have no agenda here. They have no interest. They don't like or dislike President Aristide. They've sent the Marines in, and they've wrapped a stranglehold around Haiti with the IMF, and they've pressured hard to keep wages low and all that. But that was just done kind of in a haze of confusion, or they don't even remember doing that, and they don't even know why they did it. It is amazing how people do not think, and how thinking is preempted by these labels that are thrown around. I heard the BBC interviewing one of the cutthroats who's back in power in Haiti, and they're going around now killing the people who are fighting for democracy. And he said, "Oh, that Aristide, he's crazy. He's a crazy man." So they just label. I mean, Aristide, president. I've met Aristide. I was on a panel with him in Athens at a conference. I mean, he is a gentle, decent, beautiful human being, intelligent, clear, and profoundly dedicated to the democratic development of Haiti, wanting to better his people. And here he's portrayed as a demagogue, power-hungry, corrupt. Well, there was corruption, we hear. Well, there was corruption in Haiti. Oh, yeah? There's corruption in Chicago. There's corruption in Washington, D.C. They can't get a decent municipal government there to deal with the rat population. I mean, there's corruption just about everywhere in the world. This is reason. This justifies overthrowing a president who got over 90% of the vote, who was really thought well because the man was incorruptible and he was dedicated to his people. This becomes reason to overthrow him. So what you do, it's not a particularly original scenario. It's done again and again and again. You demonize the leader. You throw out a few words like, oh, he's an admirer of Hitler or Stalin's or whatever, some stupid thought like this.
Drug trafficking, that was, of course, mentioned in this hearing.
There was drug trafficking. That was with Noriega. Yeah, with Noriega. That was used for Aristide also, that there was drug trafficking?
Yes. In the hearing, I heard there was one of the members of Congress, a Republican from Florida, who was getting grilled by people like Maxine Waters and some of the Black Caucus people that have spoken with Aristide since he's been in captivity. And this fellow, I can't recall his name, but he was from Florida, a Republican, and he was making long apologetic speeches that were barely questions, you know, basically softballing and leading questions to Roger Noriega to make the administration look good. He said, well, hasn't the CIA said that some of these people who are involved in the Aristide government are drug traffickers?
So there's a total lack of any kind of originality. It's a formula. It's a formula that's applied again and again, which is you demonize the leaders. You say he's implicated in drugs or corruption or power, or he violated the Constitution, or he wasn't really Democrat, or he was anti-West, or he was anti-American. This means if any leader criticizes U.S. policy that's come into his country and undermining his country and impoverishing his country, that leader then is worthy of being targeted because he's criticized us. If he's criticized us, he's opposed to us. If he's opposed to us, he's some kind of an enemy. If he's an enemy, he's a threat. So therefore, we will have to deal with him. And it's the same kind of scenario that's used again and again and again. Nothing particularly original about it. They don't even change the script, really. They just kind of erase one name and stick in another name and read the same script to us. And unfortunately, there are members of our nation, there are some of our compatriots fall for it every time. There are people who are justly cynical about politicians, who will say, oh, these politicians are all alike. They say one thing to you, when they get in office, they do something else. Or they say they're the friend of the little guys, but when they get into office, they serve the fat cats. I mean, they can be very cynical about politicians. But when these same politicians wrap themselves in the flag, when these same politicians start conjuring up a foreign menace that must be dealt with because America is being threatened by this or that weak, impoverished, tiny little country, these same compatriots, these same fellow citizens of ours, drop their critical skepticism, and with almost childlike trust, they say, we got to get behind the president. Now, war has been very good to George W. Bush, so much so he can't let go of it. He wants war and crises all the time. He even got up to the people and said, I'm a war president, because someone told him through history that war presidents always get reelected. Lincoln did, McKinley did, FDR did. So, but not all of them, you know. Lyndon Johnson resigned, and so forth. So this is what he's doing. He's really using these crises to further his agenda both at home and abroad.
I'm speaking with political scientist Dr. Michael Parenti, whose most recent book, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. You wrote extensively about the populares, the reformers who basically came from the aristocratic classes, but who were in sympathy with the needs of the common people, of which you said Caesar was the last of this line of people. Their assassinations obviously were major turning points for the domestic situation within Rome. The United States in the 20th century had some significant political assassinations as well. John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, King, Malcolm X. How would you compare the role of these political assassinations and the way that may have impacted the course of the United States to what happened in Rome as a result of the assassination of these figures?
Assassinations destroy the leadership. They demoralize the democratic elements. They make it clear that there's a sinister power that knocks off these people. They break the momentum sometimes of a democratic movement. So this is what the function of assassinations are. The assassinations have extended all over the world. You know, we've seen African leaders, reformist leaders who've been assassinated. We've seen in Latin America any number of leaders assassinated or driven from power or just escaping within an inch of their life. So assassination is a very important use. I mean, what the ruling classes throughout history have relied on is force and violence, ultimately. Not only force and violence, they rely on manipulation, they rely on all sorts of false ideologies, saying that their interests are the interests of everybody else, or they're doing the best and they're the better elements and all that stuff. But when push comes to shove, out comes the daggers and the guns.
Well, in the United States, whenever an important figure who is leading a reform movement is assassinated, we always have a lone nut. Was that the case in ancient Rome as well?
No, they didn't. They sometimes hid the source of the assassination, and the assassin was never apprehended. But other times it was rather wide open. The Senate would pass an ultimatum suspending all laws and protections, and they'd go out, send their boys out and kill people. They didn't make any secret of it. Well, the assassination of Julius Caesar is an example of that, where they actually made a point of killing him right in the Senate meeting house. Actually, it was in Pompey's Theater, a meeting room next to Pompey's Theater. But wherever the Senate met, that's where the Senate house is, in effect. They killed him there because they wanted to publicize it as an act of tyrannicide. And that's pretty much what it was. Today, they're a bit craftier about it, and it's always a lone nut who keeps a diary often and says, oh, I got to go kill this guy and all that. It's kind of interesting how they all keep diaries. I don't know any people who keep diaries except assassins.
Right? These various lone nut stories, at least to me, have always seemed very difficult to believe. Why are so many people apparently willing to accept these stories and not really attempt to get to the bottom of it?
Including some notable left intellectuals who I wrote about this in my book, Dirty Truths. I have a chapter on that. they are reluctant to go along with the idea that there was a conspiracy because they think the issue is irrelevant. Or what I've discovered in exchanges with several prominent left intellectuals, who I'm not going to name, they're totally ignorant of the enormous amount of research, the forensic research that's been done on the Kennedy assassination, the all sorts of other kinds of research, backup research, people who have come forward and the like. Very, very rich, very excellent, very resourceful, very ingenious investigations that have been done. They're totally ignorant of the entire body of that research. And they think the only criticism is Oliver Stone's movie on the subject. But Oliver Stone's movie was actually based on this enormous research. So they're ignorant, but like all intellectuals, they usually speak beyond their information, and they usually pronounce beyond their own knowledge. They have to have opinions, knowing opinions on everything, and their knowing opinion is to patronizingly see this as just a lot of conspiracy nuts. And they also fail to see how the implications of these assassins, of a full exposure of these assassins, which is why the powers that be cover up and cover up and cover up, a full exposure of them would have terrific political repercussions in undermining the legitimacy of the national security state. The assassination of Caesar, as I mentioned, is not, there's no mystery about it. There was a conspiracy. They conspired. They got together. They planned. They considered several different plans about how they might knock him off, and then they decided on this one right in the Senate House. We know who did it, so it wasn't one of those whodunits. It was a why done it. Why was it done? And that's something different. But the why it was done is the same as today. It's done to kill popular leaders and to try to move the country in a more conservative direction. When Kennedy was killed, Lyndon Johnson became president. The first thing Lyndon Johnson did was escalate the war in Vietnam. Kennedy was the only member of his administration who didn't want to send in a massive ground force. And this is what Johnson did within a few weeks after Kennedy was killed. He had 100,000 U.S. troops pouring into Vietnam. So they saw Kennedy as someone they had to get rid of. Kennedy was also making very friendly overtures to the Soviet Union and calling for a real detente in the Cold War, and was even reconsidering developing normal relationships with Cuba. Well, that was enough to convince these people that he was a slimy communist himself. There's a quote by Ronald Reagan in Kitty Kelly's biography of Nancy Reagan. There's a quote by Ronald Reagan about John Kennedy before he ever got elected president. Said that John Kennedy, he's a dirty little Marxist commie. This, which he wasn't at all, but this is the way the far right saw these people, and so. The reasons why they killed people then are the same as the reasons why they kill them now. And they're killing them. There's political assassinations going on right now as we talk in Haiti. These well-armed right-wing gangs are going around and killing Lavalas leaders who were bringing democracy to Haiti and were doing dangerous subversive things like raising the minimum wage from $1 a day to $2 a day, trying, as Aristide said, I want to bring my people up to third world poverty. I would like to bring them up. They are below that. They're what we call fourth world destitution. I mean, the poorest of the poor is poor. And this is what he was trying to do.
Why would the United States government be so desperate to prevent this from happening?
Because the government is in the hands of reactionary people like George Bush, Dick Cheney, and the like. The government represents that class And that class does not want people organizing collectively to redistribute the resources of society for their own collective betterment. They want the land, the labor, the natural resources, the markets, and the public treasury to be at the disposal of the few on top. And this is what they want. And you could say, it's a very modest thing. Minimum wage, change it from $1 to $2 a day. It's a modest thing, but it's an ember. It could be the start of a fire. You give these people $2 a day, then they want to organize, and then they want to better organize, then they want more from their employers. They'll want vacations, they'll want this, they'll want that. We can't allow that to be happening, these leaders say.
And I'm speaking with Dr. Michael Parenti, author of The Assassination of Julius Caesar.
Do you really think the U.S. goes into all these countries and impoverishes these people and really just tries to third worldize everybody and keep them there? Yeah, not only that, not in these countries, they're doing it right here at home. They resist any increase in the minimum wage. They want to undermine, privatize, and destroy Social Security. They want to destroy disability insurance, survivors insurance, and pension funds. That's what Social Security is, those three things. They're undermining and defunding public education. They're destroying, defunding, undermining environmental protection laws. They try to just break down, roll back every labor union that exists in the country. They want to get us back to 1900. In 1900, the U.S. was a third world country. And that's the goal, to get us back to that time.
Do you mean it was a third world country?
Half a century before the term was invented, the U.S. had widespread poverty, widespread underemployment, low wages, typhoid epidemics in some northeast cities. People lived in terrible squalor. They worked for very low wages. And the very rich at the top amassed obscene amounts of wealth. The poorer and hungrier I can make you, then the harder you will work for less and less. And that's why people today in Haiti will work for 12 cents an hour, or people in Indonesia will work for 15 cents an hour or something. It's not because they're less fussy than we are. It's because they really are so disarmed and so downtrodden. And we don't work for those wages because we are at a level of historical struggle where we've elevated ourselves. The goal of the people in power today is to roll back all of those gains. Just as the goal of the Roman Senate was to roll back all the gains made by Caesar and his followers. And they did that quite successfully. And they supported the overthrow of the Republic. They were perfectly happy to then live with emperors. And they gave absolute power to these people as long as those people used that power to protect the senator's wealth.
Over the years, you've looked a lot at the manipulation of public opinion in the media and in cultural products like films. Why does this apparently work so well? And I say that it works so well because people haven't stormed the Capitol and stormed the White House and, you know, hauled the members of the government, out into the street or anything remotely like that, you know, in retaliation for these attacks on the standard of living of the common people. How do they get away with it?
It works so well because they control the entire universe of communication. The communication universe is in their hands. You can listen to network TV we can reach hundreds maybe or thousands, but they reach tens of millions every night. And what they talk about are just, they give the party line, the ruling class line, right down the line, or they talk about irrelevant things, or they talk about the process, they don't talk about the issues. So the American people are enormously misinformed and underinformed, and that's one of the reasons it works so well. Other reasons is, of course, they play upon people's fears, as we said. They conjure up irrelevant enemies. They direct people's legitimate discontent. See, people know they're being ripped off. People know there's something wrong. But what they do is say, yeah, we know it's wrong. It's those cultural elites. It's the feminists. It's the immigrants. It's the African Americans who are getting everything. It's the this and that. And you poor white guys got hardly anything, which is just the opposite of the truth. I mean, most federal programs are snatched up by white guys, affluent white males. So they convince people and they conjure up false grievances, false enemies, false targets, and they try to redirect popular discontent. What do you have? There are literally millions of people in this country who should be mobilizing in regard to jobs, the tax burden, which is so unfair to them and all that. And what are they preoccupied about? Gay marriage. They're worrying about gay marriage. Like, your marriage is going to be undermined because these other two people want to marry each other and love each other. What the hell is that all about? What kind of a marriage do you have that it's threatened because somebody in San Francisco is holding hands with someone else of the same gender? Maybe you better look at your marriage a little more closely. But this conscious playing up of cultural issues and identity politics has kept the people pretty much distracted from the way they're getting screwed up one side and down the other. And then people get misled. I can think of a very prominent left intellectual who just last year said, maybe we have to give less attention to class issues and look more at cultural issues regarding race and gender and sexual orientation. Well, those are all very important issues, and they should be looked at, and they involve people's rights and all that. But why should we give less attention? Who's giving any attention to class issues? I mean, most Americans, and that includes a lot of American intellectuals, are trained not to see class dynamics and class power. Even when it's hitting them right in the face, they're getting whacked up one side and down the other. They're getting multi-billion dollar tax cuts for the very rich. The inheritance laws are being abolished. They're just getting it up one side and down the other. The lower middle class goes into the army. The $167 billion in aid and contracts for Iraq, most of this going to Halliburton and Bechtel and others and other 70 other corporations. They're getting ripped off left and right. Their wages are getting suppressed. Unions are getting broken. And we have some of our intellectuals saying, well, class is not that important. I mean, it's a remarkable tribute to the political culture. And Americans are also fed an ideology about the virtue of their country. The gap between what they think their country is doing in the world and what their country really is doing is one of the great propaganda victories in human history. We've never seen anything like it. People literally think their leaders are out there spreading democracy and trying to help these poor, confused, lesser, underdeveloped people, you know, with the wise ways of America. America has a special virtue and a special mission and a special role in the world, and it's so great. Well, you know, most countries have had people who believe that about their specific countries, whether this country or that one. Now we're the greatest in the world and the like. So this is what it's all about. The goal is to keep the people propagandized, keep them distracted, keep misdirecting them, keep waving the flag in their face, and keep them misinformed and ignorant. And our fight is to try to get some rays of light through all this murky darkness.
Dr. Michael Parenti, author of The Assassination of Julius Caesar and 16 other books, we spoke earlier this month. Thanks to Amanda Bellerby for her assistance with this interview. Michael Parenti will be speaking in Ithaca during a Northeast Regional Students Conference for a Global Conscience that will be held at Cornell University April 2nd through 4th.